Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each episode, we pick a recently published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. For as long as Herman Melville's Moby Dick has been a staple of the American literary canon, one element often goes unnoticed. The ship commanded by the monomaniacal Ahab on his quest to slay the great white whale is named the Pequod, just one letter of difference from Pequot, a native nation living within what is now New England. Perhaps Melville was just participating in the widespread romantic nostalgia of the age, when many corporate enterprises and commercial vessels took the name of supposedly disappearing and noble Indians. Or maybe he was simply gesturing at the reality of the industry. In the middle decades of the 19th century, when Moby Dick takes place, Native men from tribes and nations in New England constituted a huge portion of the whaling workforce, some spending decades at seas, encountering diverse peoples across two oceans, and invigorating their economically marginalized reservations with vital income. These two often forgotten seamen finally have their chronicler. Professor of History at the University of Connecticut, Nancy Shoemaker is the author or editor of seven books. The latest, just released from the University of North Carolina Press, is Native American Whalemen and the World, Indigenous Encounters and the Contingency of Race. I began by asking her to lay out the size and the scope of the whaling industry in the 19th century.
Well, the 19th century whaling industry, which is famous from Moby Dick, of course, originated around the mid-17th century. On Long Island, in East Hampton and Southampton. And English colonists worked with Indians in ways that Indians may have accepted to some extent, but that became increasingly exploitative. But the English colonists began the sort of industrial whaling. They were after only two things, whale oil and baleen, or whalebone, as they called it, and they employed Indians in great numbers as workers in this industry.
Beginning when did they start to employ great numbers of Native people?
Yeah, around 1650 or so, mid-17th century on Long Island, and then it began, Cape Cod towns did that, and then Nantucket also started, and they all used Indian laborers. So then the whales that were right offshore became scarce because of overhunting, and the industry moved offshore into the Atlantic by the mid-1700s. And so by the 19th century, which is the focus of my book, they were going around the world. You know, they went around Cape Horn to whale in the Pacific Ocean in the early 1790s. And it was similar in structure to the 200-year-old, you know, whaling industry that had started on Long Island and Cape Cod and Nantucket. Yes, and so Indians continued to be in this workforce as laborers, along with many other. It was a very diverse whaling labor force, and increasingly so in the 19th century, as a lot of foreign laborers were picked up along the way.
Did Native people work in this industry in a larger proportion than their overall population in the region? I mean, how did it become that this was a key industry that that Native people were working in?
Okay, that goes again back to the sort of 17th century.
Sure, sure.
So the longer history here, there's some dispute about whether Indians themselves whaled in southern New England, hunted whales. I tend to think not that there would be more evidence of that if they had systematically had hunted whales, particularly large whales. And but they had. There's no doubt that the Indians, the Algonquian-speaking Indians of southern New England and Long Island, that they invested a lot of their culture and economy in whale strandings. And so there's a rich cultural lore of whale rights that sachems held, the leaders of Native communities. Held these sort of sovereign rights to whales that stranded on the beach. So when the English colonists arrived, they knew whaling was profitable. The Mayflower has all kinds of sightings of whales and all this excitement on the possibility among the Mayflower separatists that settled Plymouth that they would be able to start a whaling industry. But whaling requires lots of skills and specialized equipment, none of which they had, and Indians didn't necessarily have that either, so far as we know. And but gradually it developed, and they worked from the beginning. Indians were probably the majority. We don't have exact numbers, but probably the majority of the labor force. Now, by the 19th century, of course, the Native communities in New England are completely overwhelmed by for English European settlement, and their numbers have declined from disease and warfare and removals, and whaling also probably had an effect on the decline in population because it's such a hazardous occupation. So they were the majority, and around sort of 1800, where I have the better records because I used a lot of crew lists as my sort of research method. From the crew list, you see who people are, their names, their birthplaces, their age, and so forth. And so it doesn't have a column for race, but there are various, there is a column for complexion, from which it's possible to impute imperfectly what racial heritage some of these men might have associated with. And around 1800, 1810, on these crew lists, I would guess, I don't know if I systematically calculated this from my data, but I would guess that about, well, I do have this in the book somewhere, how many were Indian on these crew lists, but there were also many African-Americans and people who were both or mixed, white, Indian, and black. And then, so they were men of color, you could say, were a substantial proportion. But then by the whaling industry really takes off in the 1830s with a new focus on sperm whales, the spermaceti wax that's in sperm whales' heads burns very cleanly, and so it made the ideal candle. And so the huge industry, led to New Bedford rising as the premier whaling capital in the world, and hundreds of whale ships, out at sea, collecting this stuff. And so they needed more labor then. They had to look beyond New England for labor. And that's where you get people like Herman Melville, you know, being hired recruiters in New York and Philadelphia, looking for native-born white or black men to work in the whaling industry, and particularly also the rise of Pacific Islanders, Azoreans, and Cape Verdeans. Mm-hmm. And so because the industry expands, the labor force expands, the native population of New England is not expandable. I mean, there are limits to how many, you know, these are small communities by 1830 of, you know, just several thousand people, only a number of which are men of whaling age, right? But nearly all of them go whaling.
So which communities are we talking about specifically? You can introduce us to some of them. I know there are many Native communities that make up this industry, but what are some of the primary ones people are coming from in the whalemen that you researched?
Okay, I spent a lot of time out on Martha's Vineyard and Cape Cod because Wampanoag whalemen were probably the most active, and the reservations and today, or the tribal communities today that have this whaling past, are the Mashpee Wampanoag on Cape Cod and the Aquinnah or Gayhead tribe, which is also Wampanoag. And then pretty much everyone else along the southern New England coastline. So Shinnecock on Long Island, very active. Very interesting how nearly all of them were whalemen, and they would often go on ships together. So you might have one ship with a crew of 30, which is like seven Shinnecock men. That was actually quite common. And some Montauk from Long Island, Pequot and Mohegan in Connecticut, Narragansett in Rhode Island. Those are sort of the majority.
Mm-hmm. And of course, in tell me if I'm misremembering this, but the vessel in Moby Dick in Herman Melville's book is called the Pequod, which is a sort of reference to the Pequod. Is that, am I remembering that right?
Yes, yes. Moby Dick is full of this sort of typical New England romanticism about Indians. And I do have a chapter in my book that's about whale ship names, whale ships that are named after Indians. And a lot of them came out of, were built in Falmouth, Massachusetts. And that they were very popular. There was, right after the Second Seminole War, I think it would be, all of a sudden New Bedford has three whale ships named Osceola.
Wow.
The Osceola 1, the Osceola 2, the Osceola 3. Yeah.
That's incredible.
I'm remembering that right.
Yeah, it's actually continuing to this day.
That was quite common.
I just was recently in Hamilton, Ontario, which has a sort of very active industrial ship front, and I remember seeing a number of industrial ships that had either Native imagery on them or Native names. And, of course, that's a different sort of a related but different history in Canada, but it is something that, that continues.
Yeah, it does seem connected to, I mean, there were also 19th century U.S. ships of war that were named after Indian tribes. And I think it's akin to Apache helicopters today and sports mascots, a kind of evoking of the nostalgic past and a certain sort of, in most cases, sort of, well, I don't know, they're diverse. I mean, the ships that were built in Falmouth were almost entirely what I call helpmates. So, you know, they were the Indians who the English saw as friendly and who helped in the stories told about them. That may not be historically what they actually did, but in the stories that English colonists told about them, they were cast as helping. So Abashanks, for instance, a squaw sachem, of sort of, I think near like Mount Hope, kind of between where Rhode Island and Massachusetts are now. I'm not actually sure where she was from originally, but Wampanoag, and I believe, and the sort of lore of these sachems and Indian rulers had, you know, Indians, they could be remembered in this very nostalgic way. Yeah.
So what is the American
industry.
Can you talk a bit about that whaling industry, the sort of corporate structure? I mean, who owned these vessels, especially as they're expanding in the 1830s? Are these individual businessmen in New England, or are they conglomerating into larger companies?
Yes. So they do become, most of them do become sort of larger corporate enterprises in the mid-19th century. But they were tended to be owned by a consortium of white New Englanders. Or in the case of Sag Harbor on Long Island, you know, whites who lived in Sag Harbor or who knew people in the area of Sag Harbor. And so whaling was a very high-risk industry, and so the owners liked to spread the risk around. And they did that in multiple ways. One was that there were usually many owners of one vessel, because if the vessel wrecked somewhere and, you know, everything was lost, then you didn't lose as much as you would if you were the sole owner. So a few might have been owned by one person, but that was really rare. And usually there were at least four, sometimes as many as 16 or more owners who owned a share of the ship. Now, they also spread risk around in how they paid their labor. So whaling was not wage work. It was paid according to shares, and those shares were called a lay. So a man who started out, he's really a boy, let's say, a typical age at which an Indian in 1830 might start his whaling career would be 14 years old, and he would start as a green hand. And he would usually be paid, at that time, maybe one out of 140. So his share of the profits was one over 140. But then they extracted all kinds of fees from that. But they were all seen, all the laborers were seen as having an investment in the business, too. Partly the under the assumption that then they would be motivated to work, but really it was because of this desire on the part of owners to spread risk around. So it was a very, for the laborers, it was very risky because they could go away for 3 or 4 years and return with nothing because they weren't paid wages. And so they were very subject to the economic conditions. If whale oil was glutting the market when their ship returned, even if they had a successful voyage, they could have a losing voyage. You know, even if they had a lot of whale oil, it wouldn't sell for enough to pay their way. Now, on the other hand, they could also get these windfall profits, so they could come back with a very successful voyage, and the economic conditions were good, and a man could, he was at sea for 3 or 4 years, perhaps, but he could kind of walk home or take a, you know, get home somehow, and with like $1,200 in his earnings. And so whaling was economically very important in terms of the income it produced for Native communities, because it was, I think, their best opportunity to make a living, even though it was so risky.
There was a period of time, at least before the industry really changes in the 1830s, that some people were coerced into work aboard whale ships. How did that happen? I mean, how did captains or companies go about doing this, at least in the late 18th and early 19th century? And then what changed in the middle part of the decade, the middle part of the century?
Yes, I would say this is sort of an important point in my book, because the previous historians who've written about this topic have tended to look at the earlier periods up to around 1820, 1830. Never written that much, but there are articles, you know, several important articles on this. And they sort of established this understanding of this history as one where it was entirely coerced. And to me, that didn't entirely make sense, because if you go out to, for instance, Dayhead, now the town of Aquinnah on Martha's Vineyard, and where the Aquinnah tribe is, and you talk to people there, they are so proud of their whaling history, even though they acknowledge, you know, they recognize it was also exploitative, but it couldn't be entirely coercive, because why would people be proud of it, and the men who were involved in it? So the coercion happened largely through, well, it happened, there were a lot of different mechanisms. One of the most common was debt indenture, or the apprenticeship system for impoverished poor people. So it was English colonists and then the overseers of Indian reservations appointed after the revolution, who were, you know, white men who lived near the Indian reservations. They were all kind of very eager. You know, they saw Indians as a sort of indigent, intemperate population. And so they used the legal system and these systems of debt indenture and apprenticeship to send Indians to sea. And there are a few instances that that I talk about in my book that were clearly, you know, outright coercion in the 1820s even. But then what happens in the 1830s is that the industry becomes, you know, again, it's this demand for labor as the industry grows really quickly in the 1830s, that Indians are sort of revalued as officers, as men of responsibility and skill, not as the sort of exploited class who will be used up until they drop. And so you see in the 1830s and into the late 19th century that Indians who stayed with the industry rose very quickly into positions as mates or officers. And so it's partly because of the demand for labor, but also the ways in which Indians, because of the classic stereotypes about Indians as being skilled with spears and throwing harpoons and having an instinct for chasing animals, those sorts of stereotypes feed create possibilities for Indians, because the stereotype implies that they are naturally good at this job. And that does so that the labor demands do not create opportunities for black men, for instance, who are increasingly sequestered to the service positions of cook and steward.
So there are a number of angles that you could emphasize in telling this story, and you explore many of them, whether it's labor or gender or the circuits of this globalizing economy and so on. But you choose to foreground what you call the contingency of race, which is in the subtitle of your book. And I think it's a really interesting choice, especially because, as one of your central points here, the native whalemen you study don't actually spend a great deal of time talking about race, about their native identity in the diaries and accounts that you found. I'm wondering how you arrived at this interpretive framework, and what do you mean by contingency here?
Yeah, well, it certainly it wasn't what I planned from the outset. I planned from the outset one book that was going to be a kind of chronological history of Indian whaling that was mostly a social history. You know, the impact on the community, on the native communities, what particularly always intrigued me from the beginning was also, though this facet of indigenous people meeting other indigenous people, you know, indigenous people traveling the world, which is sort of an oxymoron, because we always think of Europeans coming to Indians, not Indians going out and meeting other people who were often called Indians too. And so I had that particular structure in mind and was kind of bemused at myself a little bit because that didn't seem like the type of book that I was naturally inclined to write or even to read. You know, a history that was, you know, chronological and kind of straightforward about the material conditions and the impact and sort of similar to something like Jeff Bolster's book, Blackjacks, you know. It was, you know, and I was kind of worried that it was going to be the Indian version of that, you know. But my early interests were, I've always been interested in race. That's always been, since I was a graduate student, it's always been one of my strong interests. And I worked on it for, you know, I'm probably sort of known to some people for an article I wrote quite a long time ago now that's also part of my previous book, A Strange Likeness. So I didn't expect to write about race, but I guess I'm not surprised in the end that my instincts sort of took over there. And what really struck me as I was sort of doing the putting the final touches on the research and turning to writing was some of the anomalies that I couldn't believe, that I didn't expect even. You know, I never expected that that Indians would be officers or that I would find Indians had kept journals and logbooks. And, you know, I ended up, I'm sure there are more out there than what I came across, but I think, I don't know how many of those, I list them in an appendix in the back, but there are at least 10, maybe there are 20 of these Indian-authored logbooks and journals. So I never expected that. And then there were these other, I guess one that really seemed so bizarre to me was this idea of the drunk Indian or the idea that Indians could be officers in one setting, like on the ship, but that they were regarded back home in New England, the same people, they were regarded back home by their white neighbors in New England as childlike, dependent, you know, drunk, intemperate. And particularly there were these, you know, because sailors are so often associated with being drunk too. And so are Indians. It's like this, they have this common stereotype, but somehow they canceled each other out. So Indians on ships, even these two guys I feature in this, when I discuss this in the book, these two guys I feature, who did have a drinking problem, it was quite clear, but the owners didn't really seem to care, and they kept promoting them anyhow because they were excellent whalemen and highly regarded by, you know, very, they helped the owners make a profit, obviously. And mm-hmm. So I see that in terms of the contingency of race that, you know, that there's a tendency among scholars who study the history of race to see it as one idea or an idea that might change over time. There are studies of when was race invented. I guess by contingency, I just mean that part of its nature, part of race's nature is that it has to allow for exceptions or otherwise it's of no use to people as a way to diminish or, you know, a way to take advantage of other people. So for whites, whites found an advantage in white whale ship owners found an advantage in promoting Indians as officers. But they're in a sort of state of denial that this never has an impact on what they think about Indians in general. And so the same people could be in one situation. Let's say an Indian whaleman in between voyages goes to the, you know, on Martha's Vineyard, goes to the store, and one of the, you know, his whale ship captain is right there. I don't know what happens in that particular exchange, if they know each other very well, but that Indian at the store at home is going to be subjected to these stereotypes of being infantile, incapable of looking after himself, lazy, all these sorts of things, which are the exact opposite of how they were treated with so much authority on the whale ship, because that served the interests of the owners.
That's fascinating. How did white workers on whale ships respond to working under native bosses?
Well, one of the things that happens is that the Indians who are officers are often not recognized as such, which is also why the previous scholars don't see them in the records, because they're not called the Indian. They're just called by their name. And so the most important thing I did methodologically that made this book possible was looking at these crew lists and comparing them to lists of Indians collected by, like, the state of Massachusetts, and finding out who these people were. So I looked for individuals. I didn't look for people identified as Indian, because I wouldn't have found them very often. I wouldn't have found most of them in whaling records. And yet I know, so I could read a logbook. And then what I would do is, once I knew someone was on a voyage, I would go look for the logbook. I would look for the, see if there were journals by private, not the official logbook, but whaling journals kept on that voyage. I'd look for the business papers, newspaper articles, those sorts of things to find out about the voyage. And so often in the, like a logbook, for instance, Indians will be mentioned, but no one's mentioning them as Indians. Or as it turns out, the keeper of the logbook is an Indian, but it's not his job to talk about being Indian when he's, first mate on a whale ship. And so he very professionally just talks about being first mate. I think I might have forgotten your question.
No, that's it. Well, I'm wondering, in the 19th century when, especially you mentioned some of these scholars of race and whiteness, and some of their arguments is that, it's the white working class who develop their own sense of their whiteness in relationship to the more degraded status of other racialized people.
Right.
And so I'm wondering what it was like for a 19th century, Irish immigrant aboard a whaling vessel to have as his boss a Narragansett man or a Shinnecock man.
Right. So I certainly looked for that. Mm. It doesn't come up very often. I think I have maybe three or four, of course I used in the book all the examples I found of a white man commenting on this. And in pretty much every single example of an underling who's white working for an Indian, he says positive things. Mm. He says, there's this one Indian from Christiantown on Martha's Vineyard, Henry James, who is very early to rise into an officer position. And he's on a ship where one of the, where there's a memoir of this particular voyage written by someone who was a green hand, I believe, and who's white, and I traced some of the whites too a little bit in like ancestry.com and so forth to know who they were as well in order to assert that. And so this guy, George Colburn, Lightcraft, or George Colburn, I can't remember his name exactly, but so he talks about Henry James, the Indian, and he does mention that he's Indian, and says that he was lucky to be working for him, that the captain, the first mate, the second mate were all drunks and so forth, and yet the Indian was Christian. He was the best whaleman in the ship, there are, I'm sure there are some instances, I think the one Indian outside of the famous sort of Paul Cuffey family, the one Indian who became a whaling captain early on was Amos Haskins. And unfortunately, the two voyages where he's captain, There's no surviving journal or logbook, so I can't know exactly what happened. But his first voyage out, it was a majority of the workers under him were white men, and the voyage was a disaster. They were deserting, it was an unprofitable voyage. He was able to go out again, and you could see that someone had made the decision to, you could say, colorize the workforce, that they were now, he had like four Indians, two of them officers working under him. So his first mate was an Indian, George Pullane, from the same community, Gayhead. And then his, there were also more black men who were in the crew. And unfortunately, that was not a profitable voyage either. It was also a disaster, but for a different reason, which is they picked up a fever off of the sort of West African coast, and four men died and others caught the fever, and so they had to return early. And that was kind of the end of his career. But I would guess that first voyage. But there were a lot of really bad white captains, too. I mean, it was actually not a pleasant job to be captain, because many of the white men in general were inspired by this sort of white working man's rights movement of the sort of 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where they become, many of them have this sort of sense of entitlement, and they see the whale ship as tyrannical, undemocratic, but they tend to take their abuses out on African American men. It seems not so much on American Indians. There are also all these foreigners who make them uncomfortable. You know, the Portuguese and the Pacific Islanders. So the white men on board a whale ship, yeah, they may not have liked some of the Indians being in charge, but they really didn't like a lot of people. And the Indians seem to have been, I think they just invested so much in this, doing well in this occupation, that they tread very carefully in their relations with others. And so there are instances where the Indians do have to enforce discipline if they're officers. You know, they do have to put men in irons. They do have to flog men. And so they do that. But the instances where some white men accuses an Indian of this kind of abuse, I just didn't run across much of it.
And conditions are incredibly dangerous on these ships too, right? I mean, what was it like to work aboard this ship in the middle of the 19th century?
Yeah, so it did take a toll on everybody. It's impossible, you know, it would have been nice if I could have done some sort of comparison of the Indian experience with other groups, but it's actually really difficult to even reconstruct a single voyage in terms of the crew, because, you know, particularly these long voyages of 4 years, there are men deserting all the time. They're hiring people who aren't named, you know, at the Azores, for instance, which is usually the first stop for a whale ship. It was quite common to hire two or three men and just call them Portuguese, you know, and then go to the Cape Verde Islands and hire two or three more and call them Portuguese. And then all the Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders are usually called things like Jack Kanaka, John Kanaka, Bill Kanaka. So it's kind of very hard to have a static enough, even though there's phenomenal records in whaling history, it's you can't really, it would just be a horrific job to try to reconstruct whaling crews for an entire voyage. So you could do it for ones leaving because of the crew list being very informative sources. So, oh dear, again, I think I forgot your question.
No, I think you actually completely answered it. I was curious about
Oh, the dangerous conditions.
The dangers, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I remember this one map you have of all these ships that had caught fire or something. Or
yeah, no, that was actually that was a great map. It was done by Brian Pershall here at UConn, an undergraduate in our map department. I loved what he did with that. It was very, very dangerous. And so I didn't really do anything. I did sort of keep track, of course, of who died. There are some I just lost track of completely. I don't know what happened to them. And I always kind of hope I'll run across them somewhere and figure out what happened to them. But I never kind of statistically figured it out among the Indians, but I could kind of do that, I suppose. A little too late now, I guess, but
I think you've done quite a lot of research already. So,
yeah. So what I did was I decided to do it for Mashpee to do this map, which showed some of the disasters that befell whalemen. That isn't actually in those disasters that are in that map. Most of the whalemen survived, and so it's just fascinating how. They could shipwreck in the near Mauritius or something in the Indian Ocean, and they make their way home and they go out on another whaling voyage. Mm. So it was very hazardous for an individual whaleman. The most dangerous, the most frequent cause of death, I would say, is probably falling from aloft, right, either into the ocean or onto the deck. And so a lot of people die from falling. And I do mention the sort of different causes of death. Scurvy is, of course, common. Other ailments, sickness, a lot just died from consumption, which they could have died from at home as well, of course, because that was the big killer in the 19th century. Very few died while chasing whales, but a few did. They died, they were caught in the rope or something and the whale took them down. So then there are some dramatic stories of, another way was there when what happened, how it works is that, they go out in a ship with a crew of, let's say, 40 men. And when they see a whale, they lower several whaleboats, and the whaleboats have crews of 6 men, one of whom is an officer, one of whom is called the boat steerer, but he's actually the harpooner. And then 4 men at oars. And so when they see whales, and the right kind of whales, they lower these whaleboats and they chase them. And so they could be, like, chasing them for hours. And then they have to tow if they catch the whale, they have to tow it back to the ship. And so in that process, there are instances where ships lost sight of the boats. And they hope that the men can somehow make it, to some archipelago or run up to another whale ship and be saved. But, there are some men who are just lost at sea. Yeah.
So in the second part of your book, and you alluded to this a bit earlier, you explore what happens when these crews, often made up largely of indigenous men from New England, make landfall throughout the Atlantic or Pacific world and interact with indigenous inhabitants of other places. And you say that this can often be a messy affair, where perhaps we can see that contingency that you spoke about earlier. Can you recount maybe one or two of these messy affairs? What happens when indigenous crews make landfall throughout the maritime world?
The book has 4 parts, and these are 4 settings where race is configured in a certain way. The mm-hmm. racial expectations about Indians are configured in a certain way. And so the first part is about relations aboard ship. The second part is about cultural encounters. And that's where I use the term messy affair. And it's in contrast, I think the cultural encounter is just a stock feature in historical studies. And one of the most beautifully written books about 19th century Europeans in the Pacific and these sorts of encounters is Greg Denning's Islands and Beaches. And that's a classic cultural encounter narrative where everyone on the ship is European and everyone on the islands are Marquesan because it's the Marquesas where it takes place. And so you have the European and the native. And I have to say, my book, Strange Likeness, of course, juxtaposed those two groups completely also. So this is kind of what we do in often in indigenous studies. We put Europeans in conflict with Indians as Europeans expand into the Americas, or we put Europeans in conflict with Pacific Islanders as they expand into the Pacific. Well, the thing is, the workforce, whaling workforce, is so diverse that it automatically shakes these things up. And plus, also, these Pacific islands become very diverse because there are Europeans, what are called beachcombers in Pacific studies, in Pacific studies field. These beachcombers, you know, British, Americans, runaway sailors, convicts, who take up residence in these islands and have children and wives and so forth. And so both the ship and the islands very quickly become complicated settings of different kinds of people interacting. And so when the ship meets the island, it's not so easy to say this is Europeans versus Indians. And I did somehow stumble across a phrase that I liked in terms of to capture this diversity as colonization's workforce, because it would be, Indians from New England are out in the Pacific, and initially in the research I was hoping in the back of my mind or expecting or what I was looking for was a kind of indigenous commonality, a fellowship, you know, that the New England Indians would be able to see or would recognize when they were in Hawaii or the Marquesas, that the same process that had happened to them was happening there at this place. And they just, if they did see it, they didn't write about it. And instead, you know, their commitment is to the ship. And it's the same even with many of the Pacific Islanders who were picked up. You know, if an American whale ship picks up a bunch of Hawaiians at Honolulu, and they go off to New Zealand or stop at Samoa or, you know, anywhere, then they aren't really the same people. Europeans see them all as Indians. And up until around the 1830s, that's what the Euro-Americans, maritime Euro-Americans, are calling Pacific Islanders. They often call them Indians. And so they recognize it's kind of the same process of they're going out and they have a kind of romance of discovery, and they're going out and conquering islands and native people. So they have the same logic, but it's the workers who are caught up in this industry do not seem to seem kind of more caught in between, and they tend to, their interests are with the ship. Not necessarily with the Europeans, but with the ship. That is why they're there. That's where, you know, and the Pacific Islanders, you know, just, you know, if they go, let's say the Hawaiians go to the Marquesas, often the Hawaiians might be used as interpreters. But when whale ship, the American New England whalers can communicate with the islanders, but particularly when the sort of violence often broke out in these exchanges or there were conflicts that erupted, and there it's clearly the ship versus the island, you know, and it kind of doesn't matter who's on which. So there are a few instances where it doesn't end up that way, but, and so I give some instances of the two whale ships in particular from the 1830s, the Awashonks and the William Penn, and the ways in which New England Indians or Pacific Islanders who were on board these ships could fall victim to the Islanders as there's some sort of conflict that breaks out between the Islanders and the ship.
So I know we're skipping over one of the sections in your book here, but you know, want to leave something for the future readers. But I do want to, as we get towards the end of our time together, I do want to ask about the book's final chapter, which you titled "Degradation and Respect." It's in this fourth section about the reservation as another space, but one that looks quite different than the mobile spaces that you've been exploring throughout the rest of the book. And I just want to ask why you concluded on those two themes, degradation and respect, as you get towards the end of the 19th century and the slow diminution of the whaling industry in New England.
Yes, it is kind of a bit of a controversial choice. It sort of, I think, came up as I was in the review process for the book, because most people would expect that I would start with New England the most. You know, and yet I save most of my discussion for New England for the end of the book. And the reason for that is because I wanted to show, to highlight the contrast between the ways in which Indians earned respect as officers on the ship, but how none of that mattered at home. And so instead of starting, I guess, with the usual, it's also the usual story. I mean, New England Indian history, it's sort of, in a way, that chapter talks about a lot of the things that the other major books on New England Indian history talk about. The sort of development of the reservation system, the role of these overseers or guardians in sort of regulating Indians, the sort of discriminatory language applied to Indians, the ways in which Indians struggled for autonomy, such as the Mashpee Revolt. And so I save it for the end because, I want people to have seen the sort of Indian whalemen first and then to return to them at home, and particularly because that chapter contrasts the concept, the ideology of degradation that white New Englanders used, that white New Englanders applied to Indians, that they were degraded people. And they used to use that word constantly, a degraded people. And then the chapter turns to more towards the Indian point of view and their puzzlement at how their whaling work had no impact on that ideology of degradation. So, and, you know, I don't have that much commentary on it, but I do have a few Indians at, like, Massachusetts hearing at Mashpee, for instance. Some of the Indians there talk about their whaling careers and so I also in that chapter end with some of the men who early in their lives were whalemen, but who became, highly respected in their own communities by other Indians, most particularly Edwin Vanderhoop at Gayhead. And so it was to sort of contrast this lingering ideology perpetuated by whites that Indians were this degraded race and with the ways in which the Indian communities themselves used their whaling past as evidence of their abilities and self-worth. And particularly to try to end the book by bringing it up a little bit to the present, where to talk about like Amos Smalley, who's one of the last of the Indian whalemen. He was from Gayhead and did a wonderful little sort of collaborative essay that appeared in Reader's Digest about his whaling career. I Killed Moby Dick, it's called. And So Amos Molly was sort of the last of the Whalemen. And you go up to Gayhead today, his, you know, you can see the possessions of Amos Smalley's and photographs of him and the tourist shops that tribal members run up on the cliffs. And so I was trying to sort of end on the Indian perspective, and their perspective about whaling is respect, that it was something for which their people deserved respect.
So I've been speaking with Nancy Shoemaker, author of Native American Whalemen and the World, Indigenous Encounters and the Contingency of Race. It's just released from the University of North Carolina Press. You also have an edited volume that came out last year with University of Massachusetts Press called Living with Whales, Documents and Oral Histories of Native New England Whaling History, which sounds also like a wonderful text that could be really helpful in teaching. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you a sort of broader question at the end. I've tended on this podcast for no particular reason to interview a lot of junior scholars, people who are just coming out with their first book in the field. And so as someone who's published now in this field for two decades, I'm wondering if you have any broader statements about how you've seen this field of Native American history change, since your time working in it, and particularly perhaps Native history in the 19th century, which I've found is often a real gap in the historiography, that histories of Native people in New England and elsewhere tend to trail off after let's say, the War of 1812. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I've been in the business a long time. When I was in graduate school, and this was the specialization I chose for myself, it was kind of a very small field, and it had a feeling of marginality. And it's hard to remember that, because then there's been, I guess, to use people who do maritime history, unfortunately, tend to fall back on this all the time, but we rode a wave towards more work, major prize-winning books. You know, I mean, it's just been sort of amazing to see how all of a sudden Native American history came to dominate. But it really is, you're right, it came to dominate early American history up to around the Revolution. And so that's where most of these, you know, major books have been produced. So yes, I think the 19th century is ready for more, particularly, Now, I have to say, the whaling research actually really changed my perspective in a very different way, that it's actually, in a way, taken me away from Native American history to some extent to make me more global. And so I find that if someone were to ask me about sort of new directions or what's the most exciting stuff going on in the field right now, I'm interested in U.S. and the world, including, you know, indigenous people in that experience. So it isn't as though I've abandoned Native American history. It's just I see it as I'd like to see more global work done. So that North American Indians are not in these sort of isolated bubbles. Now, of course, the other big transformation in the field that's more recent is settler colonialism, which I consider sort of almost too narrow. It's kind of overwhelmed the field now, where people are just using this term all the time and very loosely. And it's sort of like how people use the middle ground all the time, like, you know, in the years after Richard White's book, Middle Ground, came out. So the settler colonialism is a new direction that's sort of supposedly comparative, but it's really just focused on British. It's mostly just done work on British descended colonies. Mm-hmm. And because of my whaling work, I've become much more interested in the Pacific. And it's kind of like doing Indian history in a way, except it's and set in the Pacific, but it's very similar. I can see, yes, it moving to the 19th century, but I'd also like to see more people looking at the U.S. and the world in the 19th century, before 1898. Yeah.
Professor Shoemaker, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Nancy Shoemaker, professor of history at the University of Connecticut and author of Native American Whalemen and the World, Indigenous Encounters and the Contingency of Race, from the University of North Carolina Press. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all of the past podcasts. We're also on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter at newbooksnatam. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.